Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell. Today I'm bringing to you Associate Professor Andrew Coggan from Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, IUPUI. He's an expert on all sorts of things. He's done a lot of training studies, a lot of tracer studies looking at metabolism, but he's also got a very interesting background that he was an elite time trialist, having won time trials in four different states in America. And he also brought out a book called Training and Racing with Power with Hunter Allen. So this is where he talked about functional threshold power and the seven different levels of training to achieve your goals. This then sort of morphed into a lot of different sort of training zone discussions. So, you know, five zones, seven zones, eight zones. And then more recently, a lot of discussion about this zone two training, where people feel like if you're not training at a relatively low intensity, then you will not be learning how to burn fat, and that will mean you'll have suboptimal responses to training. So we talk about this, and as you'll see, Andy is not a big fan of this sort of obsession about training in particular zones. And we talk about how, you know, there's plenty of ways to skin a cat, as he says, or the concept of all roads lead to Rome. And he says, you know, rather than worrying about these exact zones you're training in, worry about training specificity and what you want to gain from your training. So a very interesting discussion. I think you'll enjoy it and learn a lot. So stick around. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to Inside Exercise. Thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thanks, Glenn. I'm happy to be back. I'm doing well. on vacation down here in sunny Florida.
Yes. So you were saying, and I thought it was very nice of you to want to come on while you're actually on vacation, that you wanted to hit these grant deadlines and then go down to sunny Florida. So did you hit the grant deadlines?
I didn't hit all the deadlines, no.
Oh, crap.
So I've got two things I'm working on that have to be done even while I'm still here. So, it never ends.
So you'll be in trouble with the family, aren't you, for...
No, I warned my wife in advance that I was doing a podcast, so, and she was okay with it.
All right, good. So you've already been on, as I said, so you're actually the first. So thank you very much for being the first one to come on. We had like zero views at that point, obviously, and it's built up, so that was great. And you were actually almost the unofficial advisory board as well, because you were giving me a lot of tips and we were running ideas past. So we go back a long way. I met you in 1991, I think it was, when you were down, you came down and you popped into Mark Hargrave's lab while I was doing my PhD.
Right, right, yeah. A self-financed sabbatical is how I described it.
So you've got a very strong background. For people that don't know, you've got a very strong background for many, many years looking at all sorts of things, like training studies, tracer studies, actual guy that for a while there you were my go-to guy to ask questions about traces and things. And now you've been, after me nagging you substantially, you've been happy enough to come on to talk about zone two, training at different zones and all these sort of ideas about if you don't train in that exact zone, the world might come to an end. You were not that keen to come on because that is not your scientific background, but the fact that you've written a book on this stuff and you're like the first to start thinking about training with power. I think it's great to have you on.
Yeah, I consider that I am not a sports scientist. I'm not an applied sports scientist. I'm an exercise physiologist like you. However, as a cyclist myself and a numbers guy, when power meters became affordable and really started to catch on, just before the turn of the century, I got sucked into that rabbit hole. And since I'm a person with a lot of opinions, I started sharing them online. And the next thing you know, I'm, doing lectures for USA Cycling. And then Hunter Allen is, bending my arm and we end up writing a book and, it all just snowballed from there. But I always considered that hobby. Avocation, not vocation. It was a sidelight.
So you touched on it there. And I should say, when you came down to Melbourne, we went for a bike ride and I knew you were already strong, but I didn't expect you just to like ride away. I was like, piss me off, actually.
Well, you were a runner, though, so you know.
Specificity. I mean, you just put the hammer down and you were gone.
Specificity, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. All right, so why don't you give us a bit of an idea, and it also tracks your scientific journey as well, that you were started off in Indiana, you were like Indiana time trial champ. Take us through that, no modesty.
I grew up in Indiana. I started riding a bike when I was 14, racing when I was 15. That was my identity. That got me interested in exercise physiology while I was still a junior in high school. So Ball State was just down the road. So I did my undergraduate and my master's there with Dave Kostel. My first exposure to power-based training was actually when I was an undergraduate. Kostel wrote me a winter training program on the ergometer, 3 days a week. But all of the, I was doing intervals that had wattage targets, right? It wasn't heart rate-based training or anything like that. It was, do this interval at this duration, at this power output, and then try and push it up from there. Mm-hmm. I always consider myself the cycling equivalent of a 218 marathoner. I was good enough to dream, right? not good enough to make a living at it, but good enough to dream.
some of your dreams came true, though. Isn't it correct that you were time trial champion in Indiana, and then you went to Missouri trial champion there? And
I was partway through my master's degree when I committed myself to science rather than cycling, and I made cycling a hobby. But I'm a lifer, exerciser, and you like to stay fit. So everywhere I went, I would try and find, some competitive outlet. And since I'm skewed well to the slow twitch end of the spectrum, I was always good at time trials. And I like the technical aspects, the aerodynamics. So, I made it a goal. And so I won the time trial in Indiana. And then, moved to Texas and, won a time trial championship down there. And then moved to Maryland and Ohio and Missouri. And it's like every state I would be at, I would try and take out the TT championship. Best we ever did, we actually won the Masters National time trial on a tandem in our 90 plus age group as a Masters. And then we went out to New Mexico and set the US tandem time trial record for our age group. So nothing like motoring along at on a tandem at 32 miles an hour. John Verhuell.
Okay.
He's an environmental attorney out there now, but he was a cycling coach before he went back to law school.
I just remember while you were talking about that, that you were wired into that with the aerodynamics and you had that hooker elite. Why don't you explain that was, I'd never seen anything like that.
They were a company, Hooker Industries, Hooker Headers. There's a couple of guys in California who are very much into auto racing, drag racing, modifying cars. And then they got sucked into the triathlon explosion, et cetera, and started doing that. And they decided to apply their technical expertise and their ability with metallurgy and develop a bike brand. So they were one of the very first, full aero efforts out there. And it was pretty extreme and radical for the time. And of course, things have moved on quite a bit since then. But
So you had there's no handlebars, right?
Basically. Arrow or die. Yeah, it was arrow or die. No outboard position whatsoever, right? Handlebars were like this wide at the widest part.
You're showing about, for people, I think 15 centimeters, maybe 6 inches wide.
Yeah.
So you just had your arms forward and that was it. Yep. And I remember you telling me to get arrow. And you were like, just push, no, down. You were pushing my back down. I just couldn't, I couldn't do it. Because you would just train, like, at that, when you were leading up to time trial, you would just train in that position the whole time, yeah?
Yeah. Well, and I also, I grew up in northern Indiana where it's pretty flat and kind of windy and empty farm roads. I got quite used to just hunkering down and riding with my head down. So from a young age, there are actually data out there showing that in speed skaters, for example, the hip joint angle force relationship is skewed to a more acute angle in speed skaters than it is in untrained individuals. So okay. I think, you know, if you're doing that from a young age, you develop a little bit differently. And then you can picture somebody who, like yourself, who is a runner first, right? An upright posture. And then in, you know, full adulthood, you try to become a cyclist, you may be at a disadvantage to somebody who's been doing it since they were 14 or 15.
I just couldn't for the life of me. So you had your hips. I mean, I know we know this stuff now, but back then I was just like, what the hell? Your hips were above your shoulders, yeah? Is that what it was?
You don't get quite that low, but
no, it wasn't that low.
I had a lot of good input from various people, John Cobb, Jim Martin, etc.
And you were mucking around in tunnels, era.
Yeah, I got into the wind tunnel for the very first time in I don't know what year that was, but again, that was courtesy of connected with Jim. Then I eventually built my own wind tunnel in my basement.
That's right. Hardcore, man.
It's not a big wind tunnel, but I did build one.
All right. So if we're going to lead towards focusing around this zone two concept, which, to be honest, I hadn't heard all that much about until, you know, I started on Twitter. I'd heard about it, but then, you know, with Twitter, with this podcast, and it just keeps coming up all over the place. And zone two and zone 2A and zone 2B and various ideas about zones. Do you want to just talk about how people sort of got into these zones and indeed your own, you know, zones that you had with your functional threshold power, et cetera?
Yes. I don't know who the first person who would have been who would propose training zones or even when it might have been, but certainly as a young and growing up, I think I was exposed to the notion of heart rate based training zones. Then when power meters started to catch on, it was actually a chance conversation with John Verhuell in the infield at Trexler Town at the velodrome there. He was part of a coaching company at the time that had their own heart rate based training zones. Mm-hmm. And he realized that power was taking off, and he was telling the person he was talking to, they're talking about watts, et cetera. And he was telling this person that he was talking to that he wanted to be the first to translate their heart rate based zones to power based zones. So it was about a 2-hour drive home from T-Town to where I was living in Maryland at the time. And I left the velodrome and I'm driving home and I'm thinking as I go, well, there's really a power vacuum here, you know, pardon the pun, but yeah, SRM had been available to the Greg LeMonds of the world, for the Australian Institute of Sport, for maybe, you know, 8 years or so. But at that level, people are not in the business of sharing all of their hard-won knowledge. They're trying to, you know, win medals and make money and keep all of their secrets to themselves. So there wasn't a lot of information out there. And I'm driving home, and of course, I have an ego as big as the Golf here that I'm sitting right next to, and said to myself, it's like, well, you know, somebody needs to step up and, you know, fill this void. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was the perfect person because of my background in exercise physiology and the fact that I had gotten early exposure. You know, I jumped on the power bandwagon. So I started out by developing my 7 training levels and power-based training levels. But on the wattage list, when I used to participate, we would have what we referred to as pithy power proverbs, short little phrases that summarized a concept. You get tired of trying to explain it over and over again, so you end up with a shorthand notation.
Okay.
And the relevant pithy power proverb here is, they're called levels and not zones for a reason. And that is, when people are training on the basis of heart rate and heart rate based zones, they have this notion that, well, if I'm doing a zone X workout, then I just, you know, modulate my exercise intensity to keep my heart rate within that range at all times. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, when you apply that to power on a bicycle, your power when cycling outdoors is highly variable. I mean, people know this, but they're still surprised when they get a power meter. But if you think about it, when you're pedaling, your power is something. and then you coast as you go around the corner and your power is zero. And then you stand up to accelerate again, and now you get a spike in power. So if you then apply a typical zone sort of perspective and you try and constrain your power output to keep it always in the same range, you become a diesel engine. You become a lorry, right? It's not the way we ride bicycles, and it's counterproductive to the overall effects of training, because you need to be able to change speed, right? Take a triathlete, throw them into a mass start bike race, and they get eaten alive, right? Because they're not used to changing. So
they're riding like a time trial the whole way.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I did is I borrowed the word levels from Chris Boardman's coach. Peter Keen had his own system, right, which he referred to different levels. And I thought, well, levels at least hopefully will make people think differently than zone. And then it all sort of snowballed from there. USA Cycling caught wind, asked me to give talks. Hunter Allen sucked me in. We ended up with 3 editions of our book, 100,000 plus copies sold, 8 different languages. made a lot of other people's careers. For what for me was really just a hobby.
is it in Slovenian?
No. Not to my knowledge, no. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, Roglic and Pogacar, right? They're both Slovenian. First and second. Yeah. All right. We might head in that direction.
Slovenian or
stage.
Slovakian? Are they Slovenian?
No, Slovenian. Slovenian, I think.
Okay.
All right. So there's going to be controversies along the way. One I just thought of is, it might be a bit of a tangent, which is what you said. You said we should have a bit of a script, because we tend to go off on tangents. But what was the deal with your, there's a suffer score, yeah? And then there's your FTP, and there was a bit of a controversy at Trainer Road or something about whether you should use suffer score instead of FTP, or have I got that wrong?
Well, the starting point was the training levels, but the endurance exercise performance, the single most important physiological determinant of endurance exercise performance is your, what I call your muscular metabolic fitness, as a counterpoint to cardiovascular fitness describing VO2 max. And our lab-based measurement, the standard lab-based measurement of muscular metabolic fitness is lactate threshold. Now, there are at least 27 different quantitative definitions of lactate threshold out there in the scientific literature, right?
Okay.
But as a concept, it can also be just viewed as a concept, right? And the fact that it's a well-established concept is probably why there are 27 different definitions, in that if you go to a meeting and you say, we were testing this cyclist and their lactate threshold was really close to their VO2 max, right? You know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know which definition I was using, right? Yeah. And if you got really curious and you wanted to say, well, how close? It was at 98%. Well, how are you measuring lactate threshold? Yeah. Oh, we use the 1 millimolar increase above exercise baseline. It's like, oh, okay, go on, right?
Exactly.
So as I describe it, there isn't any evolutionary pressure in the field to achieve any kind of standardization, because there really isn't a need from a conceptual point of view, right? We can still communicate with each other. With that in mind, knowing that your metabolic responses are the most important determinant of performance, and I grew up as the concept of lactate threshold was developing, right, and displacing VO2 max as the be-all and end-all. And even as a grad student, okay, now what, 40 years ago, I was saying, the best predictor of performance is performance itself.
Yeah,
right. It always will be, right? There's a perfect correlation. There are physiological descriptors of it, but you don't want the tail wagging the dog. Performance trumps all, right? So now we have power meters on bikes. We have the ability to measure someone's performance ability in terms of their power output. We know that their muscular metabolic fitness connects to, predicts performance across a very broad range of durations, right? So the logical anchor point is a power output that is a surrogate for the lactate threshold concept, right?
Yep.
Well, the other issue is, you know, and coaches and athletes are so confused because if you use some of the definitions of lactate threshold, you know, the first apparent increase, you know, above resting or something like that, it's a far lower exercise intensity than what athletes and coaches perceive to be threshold. And that creates confusion. What? You're telling me my threshold is this? I know it's this, right? They come out of the laboratory.
So that's the thing. So can I just say, so for example, as you said, there's all these different definitions of lactate threshold. So you know, the classic one is you know, you just so people are on the same page. So your lactate, you know, people might think, oh, there's no lactate sitting here at rest, but your lactate level's about 1 millimole or so at rest. Then you start exercise, but it's still low intensity and it stays about one and it doesn't really change. So people might think, oh, nothing's happened. But in fact, you're producing lactate at a higher rate, but you're clearing it at the same rate. So it's not accumulating. And then it starts to accumulate, right? And then some people, okay, that's lactate threshold one. Other people say, no, let's not worry about that. Just wait until it's 1 millimole above that resting level. But as you're saying, you could do like a 1 hour time trial and sit at 5 or 6 millimoles.
Or 7 or 8, actually.
Exactly.
Okay. Connected to that, and for the edification of your audience, you know, to me, if people think about it, why is the onset of blood lactate accumulation defined as 4 millimolar? I mean, if resting is one, you're saying, well, wait a minute, you've already accumulated a whole lot. So why do we call that the onset? So I think to understand that, you have to learn to think in multiple dimensions, because not only do we have to think about intensity, but we also have to think about duration. So OBLA, 4 millimolar, is the average lactate concentration across various, you know, runners, swimmers, rowers, cyclists, corresponding to maximal lactate steady state. So if you are well below, you know, if it's a very low intensity, you may not see any accumulation of lactate at all. If it's a slightly higher intensity, your lactate levels may go up initially, but then after 20, 30 minutes, they go back down towards resting levels. If you go a little bit harder, they go up and they'll plateau. If you go a little bit harder still, they'll go up and they'll plateau. If you go a little bit harder still, they increase continuously. So that happens on average at about a 4 millimole level. But it seems to be dependent upon the amount of muscle mass, the mode of exercise. So for cyclists, at least trained cyclists, quite typically maximal lactate steady state corresponds to a blood lactate concentration of maybe 7 millimolar. So yeah, back to the 4K, 40 kilometer TT, you know, your average trained, well-trained cyclist is probably just sitting there at 7 millimolar for the duration of the event.
So what do they do with that? So, you know, if they had a lactate threshold, if they'd actually gone in and paid to have a lactate threshold test done, what do they do with that? My feeling was always that...
I'm throwing up my hands here. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's a one-off test. You know, it would tell you what your physiological state is at the, you know, the day you took the test. But unless you go back repeatedly, it's not really useful for tracking improvements. The other thing is that it's far more variable than what people realize. You know, we can reproduce performance, you know, plus or minus 2% in a laboratory setting. In the field, because it's not a controlled laboratory setting, maybe plus or minus 5%, right? But then when you talk about measurement of, you know, some lactate threshold surrogate, right, the coefficient of variation is quite a bit larger. The retest reproducibility isn't that great, because lactate depends upon, you know, how much glycogen you have stored in your muscles, et cetera. So again, people have it, they think that lab-based testing is the gold standard and everything else is a poor man's substitute, and they have it backwards. The best predictor of performance is performance itself. And, you know, lab-based testing is the poor man's substitute, or it is the, it may help you understand things mechanistically if you're a scientist, but it's not the gold standard. And this is one thing that I do would say that I agree with, and the perspective that Andy Jones is and David Poole have tried to put out there in pushing critical power as the new gold standard, in that they are also, you know, of the opinion that performance trumps all.
Okay, so why don't you, we're heading towards zone two, but we need this sort of background. Seeing as you've mentioned critical power, why don't you just explain what that is and for our listeners?
Critical power was first developed by Monod et al. In the 1950s, a mathematical model to describe performance over varying durations with small muscle mass exercise, let's say repeated knee extension, for example. Mm-hmm. Conceptually, you have a critical power that can be maintained indefinitely, infinitively, forever, right? And above that, you have a limited amount of work that you can do. So if you are at or below your critical power, you should never fatigue. Mm-hmm. And then if you're above your critical power, how quickly you would fatigue would depend upon the magnitude of your, originally it was referred to as anaerobic work capacity. Now the realization is that it's, for the last couple of decades, is it's not entirely anaerobic. So now it is W prime, W for work. So you have a certain non-sustainable reserve, and the higher you are above critical power, the more quickly you will deplete it. The less you're above your critical power, the longer it will last, but eventually you will deplete it and have to slow down to critical power. So that's the concept proposed again in 56 or so. It took until 1979 until DeVries and Moratani extended it to whole body exercise using cycling. And there are various mathematical permutations on this. You know, you can either plot work against time or, one over power versus time, et cetera, different manipulations, but it comes down to a two parameter model of the exercise intensity duration relationship. It started out again, primarily as a mathematical descriptor, and then people began to develop more and more physiological basis for it or impetus for it. And I'm going to let you get a word in edgewise here, because otherwise I'll just go off on a real long tangent.
No, it's good. I guess I'm wondering, what do you actually do with that? So,
all models are wrong, but some are useful, right? Mathematical models often are better at generating new questions than they are actually answering current questions. But one example of it, you can, instead of using power, you can use pace. And so you can talk about your critical pace and your D prime, your distance prime. Mm-hmm. So for my son, who's a swimmer, I use his 100, 200, and 500 yard distances. And I use a linear variation of the critical pace model. And so I track improvements in his critical swimming speed and critical distance, as he develops, et cetera, et cetera. Now, given that, performance, the best predictor of performance is performance itself. If you want to have a zone system, and I'll come back to that in just a second, mm-hmm. The logical anchor point is performance, not maximal heart rate, not VO2 max, even though historically in exercise physiology, we describe exercise intensity as a percentage of VO2 max. That's really only the best approach if you're talking about cardiovascular responses, because it's a measure of cardiovascular fitness. More generally, anchoring things on quote unquote lactate threshold, muscular metabolic fitness, makes a lot more sense. So you could build an entire zone-based system around critical power. And, but obviously we're getting, off in the weeds here, talking about mathematics, right? And all this kind of stuff. And power meters for cyclists are just becoming available. And the problem is people are really confused because they think they all want to be scientists, right? So my attempt to kind of cut through all of the confusion was just to wipe the slate clean and say, forget about the physiology. You don't need to understand the physiology. but you know that there's a certain intensity that you can sustain, right? I can hold this. And if I ask you to go a little bit harder, you're going to very quickly realize I can't keep this up, right? Functionally speaking, there is a quote unquote threshold power, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a true threshold because all exercise responses reside on a continuum, including lactate and ventilation. So to refer to things as a threshold is a mental convenience. We simplify everything down and we draw a hard line in the sand and we call it, you know, black and white. You're above your threshold, you're below your threshold. When in reality, it's a curvilinear relationship with a, you know, narrow bend in it, but it's clearly still bending even in that range. But nonetheless, let's forget about lactate, forget about everything you know. Let's just talk about, functionally speaking, you have a threshold power. And this can become a good anchor point for, well, how do we communicate with people? I told my athlete to go easy. They have a power meter. Well, how easy is easy, right? Mm-hmm. That's how the original training levels were born. And I think the entire purpose of training levels or zones or whatever, it's really just a language to aid in communication. You know, there's nothing magic that occurs about training at a particular intensity that wouldn't occur if you went just a little bit harder or just a little bit easier, because it's all a continuum. But if you need to, you know, I'm a graphic person. I can sit here and draw lines and graphs and, you know, all day long. But if you're trying to communicate with somebody in language, you need some kind of systematic approach. And that was the basis, the original training levels.
Yes. Now, with when I first started hearing about zone two and tried to work out what it was, I actually thought it was talking about your second level, but it's not. So why don't we talk about what zone two is? And how there's a bit of a prevailing view that you, if you want to increase your fat oxidation and et cetera, you need to sit in zone two and try not to deviate. And then maybe some of the physiology behind that.
At least some of the confusion that's out there is due to the fact that there are multiple systems. At the simplest, you have the Norwegian approach, I guess you'd say Norwegian, that Seiler always embraces, where you really only have three different ranges, right? In which case, you know, it's one, two, and three. Mm-hmm. So two is the middle one. when I was developing my training levels and trying to think about, well, how do cyclists train in order to prepare for competition, I decided that seven was the magic number. That seven was sufficient to cover all the bases. And, you know, I couldn't get by with one less, and I didn't want to go with one more because it made it unnecessarily complicated. If you're going on heart rate, well, you know, any heart rate based system is capped at maximal heart rate. Mm-hmm. So, it doesn't really apply to, you know, supra maximal above VO2 max efforts. So the most common heart rate based system, probably Joe Friel's, I'd guess, has five, right? All right. So, okay, you know, one, two, three, four, five, or one, two, three, or one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. But all of these twos don't necessarily perfectly align.
No.
You know, it's in the history of training for endurance sports, I say Zapotec, you said Zapotec?
Zapotec, I thought it was. Email, yeah. Zapotec.
Well, you're the runner, so yes, you're the runner. We'll go with your pronunciation. Okay. You know, credited with inventing interval training and then the whole no pain, no gain era to follow, it was a reaction to that, where Joe Henderson published his popular book on long, slow distance training, the humane way to train. No more, you know, torturing yourself day in and day out with vomit inducing intervals. You can go out and just run at a steady pace, et cetera. So he really popularized it, even though you would say that from New Zealand, who's the Lydiard.
Lydia.
You know, Lydiard certainly had people doing, you know, plenty of endurance-based training. So it would be, you know, zone two is long, slow distance. It's all day pace. It's, you know, it's a comfortable pace. It's, you know, we all know it when we see it, right? But in each different system, it's there may be overlap, but they don't necessarily overlap perfectly. And then people want to try and tie it to some physiological marker, which doesn't make a lot of sense because most people don't have access to the physiological measurements. It doesn't make a lot of sense because it's all a continuum anyway. It doesn't make a lot of sense because the best predictor of performance is performance itself. It doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, performance is a function of your muscular metabolic fitness, which is the most important determinant of performance over a very broad range of intensities. So, you know, why are you trying to tie it to, you know, LT1, right? As if LT1 is different from LT2. They're not, you know.
Actually, sorry, just explain that to people, what you're talking about with LT1 and LT2 and why you're saying that they're not different.
Well, okay, lactate threshold, LT, if you're plotting lactate as a function of exercise intensity, let's say during an incremental exercise test. Now, the absolute lactate levels are going to depend upon, you know, your current glycogen stores, your, you know, the length of the stage increment, whether you're measuring lactate in venous blood, arterialized blood, arterial blood, whether you're talking about whole blood lactate or plasma lactate. And maybe even if you're doing the, you know, capillary blood, it may differ depending on whether you're getting an ear prick or a finger prick.
And if you see how much you squeeze it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Or how much sweat gets in it, or the particular brand, the handheld analyzer you own, you know, there's a million sources of variability. But at the end of the day, as you were pointing out previously, initially there are minimal changes in lactate and then they begin to increase more rapidly thereafter. So people like to look at that and say, okay, here's the first uptick in some subjective manner. We'll call that LT1. And then we know that there is a maximal lactate steady state. It's hard to determine from an incremental exercise test, but somewhere out there is an LT2, right? The onset of continual blood lactate accumulation. The problem with all of this is that it's really a continuum. And if you threw an exponential curve on there, that would fit better than any kind of piecewise linear regression, right? There are no actual breakpoints. And as a consequence, like Ira Jacobs demonstrated, a single blood lactate measurement, if it, you know, at the right intensity, at say, you know, 200 watts, is as predictive as doing, you know, a full curve.
Okay.
You just need to know one lactate value, right? Because it tells you where the curve is positioned and it's all a continuum.
That's why you said it's not different. Just when you said LT1 and LT2 aren't different, I just didn't want people to think they were the same exact lactate measurement. You're just saying they're just a continuum. You might as well just do one.
They're a distinction without a difference. Is that the phrase? Right.
And remember how people used to, I don't know if they still do, but I tried to do it once in a while. And, you know, they tried to say, okay, when the lactate does this, the ventilation does that. And then you try and draw the lactate breakpoints against the ventilation breakpoints. You do that in pracs and things. And
And then you can dissociate ventilatory threshold from lactate threshold by, you know, McArdle's disease, the classic, by pedaling really fast, by pedaling really slow, by having really high glycogen, by having really low glycogen. If you do interval training, it tends to increase your ventilatory threshold more than your lactate threshold. If you do continuous training, it tends to increase your lactate threshold more than your ventilatory threshold. So we have lots of evidence out there that they aren't cause and effect, even though they may, terms of human physiology, they tend to be closely associated. They're clearly not cause and effect. Sorry, Carlman Wasserman.
So with the zone two, now why don't we talk about why are people so, so I started talking about on Twitter, it's just zone two. And I even gave it, I gave a talk on a couple of podcasts. And then, you know, as I do on Twitter, I ask people this questions, and there's a question like, I was going to talk about, you know, carbohydrate metabolism during exercise. And one of the questions is, ask him about zone two, you know, just everything's zone two. Why don't you give us a background on, you know, how people are, why they're so keen on this zone two. In terms of fat oxidation, lactate, all that stuff.
There's been a long-standing misconception that you need to oxidize fat in order to become better at oxidizing fat. In reality, your muscles are quite good at oxidizing fat, even in the untrained state. At rest, for example, muscle relies almost entirely on fatty acid oxidation to provide its rather low energy needs. But if carbohydrate availability is restricted, you can exercise all the way up to, 70% of VO2 max, to use my classic exercise physiologist anchor point, VO2 max, with an R of 0.7. It's not necessarily pleasant, but you can provide the energy. That said, since Halsey's work in the late 1960s, it's been known that endurance exercise training increases the capacity of muscle to oxidize fat as a fuel source. But you don't have to oxidize fat to actually induce those adaptations. They're primarily the result of an increase in, mitochondrial respiratory capacity, where the two primary drivers are the energetic state of the muscle, during exercise training, and calcium release. And it's these factors are what, cause you to produce more mitochondria, which then results in an increase in fat oxidation capacity. You don't actually have to oxidize fat to get better at oxidizing fat. Yet people have long thought that you need to.
Yeah, so just to make sure, because you mentioned the R of 0.7, to make sure people are clear on this. So the idea is that, we know that when you're exercising in a low, so as you said, sitting at rest, unless you've just had a high carbohydrate meal, but sitting at rest, if you're fasted, you're burning mainly fat. You start exercising at a low intensity, you're burning mainly fat. As it gets harder and harder, you burn more. So we'd often say, the studies, Rominge, et cetera, Van Loon, and earlier stuff, 65% in a trained person of VO2 max is about where you're 50-50. And then when you go harder, it becomes more carbohydrate. So the idea there is when your respiratory exchange ratio is 0.7, you're burning 100% fat, essentially. When it's 1, you're burning 100% carbohydrate. So you're saying if you're on a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, you can exercise maybe at 70% and be burning almost entirely fat. But, yes. But the idea there is that the people are thinking, okay, I want to get better at burning fat so I can spare my muscle glycogen, I can do better in exercising. But
That's a valid thought.
Yes.
But then the question is, how do you do that? And the way you do that is
you do not need to burn fat to learn how to burn fat more. You just want to increase your mitochondrial volume.
Yep.
And you can do that by various means.
Oh yeah, many means. If you look at the animal literature, these are not new questions, obviously. But if you go back to the animal literature, so again, Dudley, 1984, some of the work out of Halsey's lab in the mid to late 70s, training rats at different intensities, different durations, et cetera. It seems that, muscle respiratory capacity increases with increasing intensity of training, in part because you're recruiting more and more motor units, right? It increases with increasing duration of daily training up to about 2 hours a day. And then beyond that, in a rat, it doesn't seem like you can necessarily induce markedly greater improvements. Now, stimulate the muscle 8 hours a day or 24 hours a day, and you may get some further increase. But there clearly is a big bang for the buck, when you first start working the muscle. And then eventually, a tendency to sort of saturate the system. So then, that leads into all kinds of practical questions about, what's the best training program? And then it devolves off into, what are you training for? Who are you? How much time do you have available? How much motivation do you have, et cetera? And ultimately, at the level of the individual, science can't really answer those questions, right? Mm-hmm. You see people posting on a forum, hey, I'm so many years old, I've been training this way for a few months, my FTP is up to this, what are the odds I can get it up to 5 watts per kilogram? It's like, well, there's only one way to find out. Is it Yoda, right? It's like, do or do not, there is no try, right?
All right. So So basically, there's a couple of things talking about there, but we know that there's different ways of increasing your fat oxidation. You don't have to exercise at low intensity burning fat to get there. So classic stuff, you know, the whole HIIT stuff, the high intensity intermittent training, there's lots of evidence that you get essentially the same increases in VO2 max, you get same increases in your mitochondrial enzymes, et cetera. So that's showing very clearly. And you're right. Saying even if you don't burn much fat at all, just say you're doing intervals right. Twice a day, every day, if you get an increase in mitochondrial volume, so you get the increases in the oxidative enzymes, the fat enzymes, then you'll burn more fat during the exercise. Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Now, what about this thing, though, that people are worried about? Ah, but when I'm exercising, if I go too hard, I'll get lactate and that's going to inhibit my lipolysis. So for a start, I guess you're saying, well, who cares anyway, because you don't have to be burning fat during the exercise. But do you want to just talk around that concept?
Yeah. So the misconception that you need to oxidize fat in order to get better at burning fat has been around for a long time. The current myth that, if I go too hard early in a workout, it takes a long time to reset my metabolism, seems to be coming entirely from San Milan and his recent podcasts. And I think people are paying attention because of who he coaches. I can't pronounce his name.
Pogacar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the idea that lactate inhibits lipolysis, which I believe is what San Milan is resting his belief system on, actually goes back to a hypothesis from the 1960s where Bella Izaskus and I don't remember his wife's name, but Izaskus and Izaskus. So this was in the heyday of carbon-14 based metabolic tracers, and Izaskus studied exercising dogs with 14 C labeled glucose, 14 C labeled fatty acids, et cetera, et cetera. It is true that if you go, hard during exercise and your lactate levels are elevated, your fatty acid levels will be suppressed. Mm-hmm. And Izaskus hypothesized that lactate inhibits lipolysis. What we know now, and what we've known since, as long as I've been in the field, right, is that hypothesis is incorrect. The real explanation for why fatty acids are suppressed during high intensity exercise is that they require blood flow and albumin delivery to adipose tissue to remove the fatty acids or to release the fatty acids. Mm. Because fatty acids are not water soluble, and the albumin in your plasma is basically the shuttle bus. Mm-hmm. So during high intensity exercise, when you redistribute more of the blood flow away from adipose tissue, you may have a high rate of sympathetically mediated fat breakdown, i.e. lipolysis, but the fatty acids can't escape from the adipocytes. Then when you stop exercise or lower the intensity and, you get more blood flow into the adipose tissue, fatty acids will actually rebound.
Overshoot.
And so they can show a big overshoot post-exercise. Mm-hmm. How long does all of this take? And what effect that has time-wise on muscle metabolism? It's something that's difficult to study. Absolutely, because some of our tools like indirect calorimetry require a steady state. And so if you were fluctuating power every 30 seconds, well, indirect calorimetry is not a tool that would really be helpful there. But for my dissertation, one of the projects, we had cyclists who were drilling it at time trial pace for 15 minutes. And then they went at, easy pace for 15 minutes. And then they alternated that as long as they could. And you see this little, seesaw action in terms of fatty acid levels, in terms of glycerol levels, et cetera, every 15 minutes, where fatty acids go down during the intense exercise and then up during the easier exercise and then back down again. And in that case, we were using respiratory exchange ratio over the last 5 minutes of each 15-minute block. And if you look at the metabolic rates of substrate oxidation, plasma concentrations of substrates, et cetera, during the moderate intensity blocks, they mm-hmm. look pretty much the same as if the high intensity blocks never took place.
Okay.
So that says you must reset within 10 minutes reset, right? Quote unquote. You think about elevation to plasma catecholamines. Well, plasma catecholamines have a very short half-life. You know, you go really hard at the in an attack during a race, and your catecholamines go really high, and then the brake is caught, and you tuck back into the field and draft for a minute or two. They're right back where they were because they're cleared so rapidly. So this whole notion that, you know, it takes a prolonged period of time to reset metabolism has no physiological basis whatsoever. In addition to the fact that you don't, you know, who cares? Because you don't have to burn fat in order to get better at burning fat.
Right. But there is this concept, I guess, that, you know,
the ultimate killer here. I can't resist this. The ultimate killer, right? George Brooks's lab did an interesting study where they did a lactate clamp. So mm-hmm. they infused unlabeled lactate to elevate lactate levels. And then they also, since lactate is a base, if you just infuse like sodium lactate, you'll become alkalotic. They also infused enough acid in order to maintain pH, right? Mm-hmm. So at a moderate intensity, they could increase lactate concentrations as if you were exercising at a higher intensity mm-hmm. and then hold them there, a lactate quote unquote clamp, much like the classic glucose clamp. And they were using stable isotope tracers to measure substrate kinetics, including the rate of appearance of glycerol, which is produced as a result of the breakdown of triglycerides in adipose tissue and muscle, is considered the best measure of the rate of lipolysis. And when they elevated lactate concentrations, there was no significant difference in the rate of appearance of glycerol. In fact, it actually tended to be higher in the lactate clamp study.
Wow. Okay.
Whereas if lactate suppressed lipolysis, it should have diminished the rate of appearance of glycerol. And I only bring this up because, you know, the grand irony here is that San Milan seems to be, you know, heavily influenced by George Brooks.
But not in that regard.
Apparently not. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that
I don't pull punches, as you said earlier, right?
Okay. I think that pretty much covers that. But if Sam Milan was here, how would he respond to that, do you think?
Well, and again, I don't want to point the finger too hard because, quite honestly, I can't stand listening to podcasts.
Hey, hang on. Don't turn people off listening to podcasts.
I don't even listen to my own on this one. people talk too slowly for me. I'd rather read it, draw a graph, give me words. If it's how to repair my dryer, I'll watch the video, but only
I'll just cut that out. I'll modify it for you to say, okay. Everyone listen to the podcast.
The only podcast I listen to is Inside Exercise. So I'm basing this more on what I'm reading on various web fora, et cetera. So it's possible that his message is getting distorted a little bit before it gets to me. That's quite possible.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I thought earlier when you were talking about heart rate. So, you know, back when people were, you know, before people were thinking about lactate thresholds and power zones and things, exercising on heart rate. And that's another one that you get cardiovascular drift, right? So if you're, because I've heard people quite often say, I'm going to run this, I'm going to run at 140 beats today. I said, you know, but if you're doing like a 2-hour run or something, you're going to have to slow down, you know, like because you get this cardiovascular drift. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I know you said
we had one of the pithy power proverbs was cardiac drift is a fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're never going to have a perfectly constant heart rate. Your heart muscle itself will fatigue during prolonged, you know, moderate intensity exercise. It's the reddest of the red, the slowest of the slow, the most fatigue resistant muscle, but it may exhibit some evidence of diminished function as a result of prolonged intense exercise, i.e. cardiac fatigue. And how well your heart functions is also heavily dependent upon the environment in which it's operating, filling pressures, etc. So as you warm up and you have to vasodilate your skin to cool yourself. You may have diminished, central cardiovascular pressure, which will reduce stroke volume. You're no longer stretching the heart. You can't take advantage of the Frank Starling mechanism as well. Yet you need to maintain cardiac output to provide the oxygen to the exercising muscles. And now you have to send more blood out to perfuse the skin. And if stroke volume is going down, the only thing you can do is increase heart rate. Just pump faster, right? So, even in a laboratory-based setting where you are, well below any kind of major disruption to metabolic homeostasis, well below, quote unquote, lactate threshold, critical power, maximal metabolic steady state, functional threshold power, whatever you want to call it, you'll see some upward drift in heart rate. Even just core temperature increasing over time, causing, AV node to depolarize more rapidly, more readily. So cardiac drift aerobic is a decoupling fact of life.
What's this aerobic decoupling?
It's cardiac drift.
Yeah. So that's just cardiac drift.
That's just cardiac drift.
But what's this aerobic decoupling business?
Well, it's, I think Joe Friel is the one who came up with that term. A perfectly coupled mitochondrion, there's not really a single one, but a perfectly coupled mitochondrion, in theory, the P to O ratio should be, three. We get three ATP produced for every one half of an O2 utilized, right? Mm. Mitochondria, even in a healthy person, are not perfectly coupled, but they can become less well coupled. They can become uncoupled. It could be due to mitochondrial diseases. It could be due to uncoupling proteins that are expressed within the muscle. It can be due to chemicals, drugs, rotenone is a mitochondrial uncoupler. So people would, in Indiana, they'd, poison a pond with rotenone and all the dead fish would float to the surface, thought it was a cool thing to do.
Okay. I thought it was weird enough how they painted the river green. So when, because I went to Ball State as well, I couldn't believe it. There I was. I just started the environment. There was no environment group at Ball State in 1989. So I started one. It's called Common Ground. I'm more worried about the environment. And then it's St. Patrick's Day and the river's dyed green.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Anyway, I need to tell you about my new electric car someday.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, I just thought aerobic decoupling. I mean, there's so much more going on.
Yeah. So drift. I think Joe Friel kind of conflated the two, or just borrowed the term uncoupling, decoupling, and came up with aerobic decoupling. But it's really just cardiac drift. The terminology aside, confusion that might create, the biggest issue here is it's been proposed that when your cardiac drift is below, a certain amount, then that's a sign that your base is fully developed and it's time to move on with your training. You're shaking your head. we know that endurance exercise training reduces cardiac drift, but really that's a measure of, or a reflection of, your cardiovascular fitness, right? Yet, performance is mostly dependent upon your muscular metabolic fitness. And where this arbitrary cut point comes from in the first place is also totally unclear, right? I think it's basically you pursue the type of training necessary to maximize the capabilities required for your chosen event. And you keep doing that until you stop making forward progress performance-wise.
Yes, performance is the end point. You keep saying it. Performance is the best indicator of performance.
Yeah, the best predictor of performance is performance itself. Yeah. So, there you are. You're a cyclist. You took some time off in the fall. You trained diligently over the winter. You've been progressively increasing the volume, frequency, intensity of your training all spring long. And you keep working at it. You keep working at it. And finally, you're reaching a point where things aren't going up anymore. Well, there's either, one of two things to do at that point. It's either change your training, focus on some other aspect, or it's time to go racing, right? Because you're not necessarily going to make any further progress by just keeping, you know, keep beating your head against the wall. But also, you know, don't stop beating your head against the wall if you're still improving, just because of some, you know, aerobic decoupling says I should.
So I think several times we've talked about how, you know, there's different ways of training to get the same sort of responses. And then this fits well with, so last week I spoke with Michael Joyner, so I'm going to put his up in a few days time, so about the sort of the history of endurance training. And one of the things he talked about, which fits perfectly with this, was, you know, you talk about sometimes this concept of all roads lead to Rome. So can you end up the same sort of athlete by doing different types of training? And he had the great comment, because he said in the Tokyo Olympics, it was like all roads lead to Tokyo, because in the 5,000 meters, you know, the first, second and third were all within a meter of each other, and they had totally different training. So one was like mainly long, slow distance. One was intervals twice a day. One was a combination, whatever. So I guess that fits what we're talking about, right? We don't have to sort of obsess about, oh, I need to be doing this. And then even the thing you said about racing, he said, even the people that did long, slow distance, people said, oh, well, that's all you need to do. And he said, no, they actually would race once a week or once every couple of weeks. So they are getting that high intensity training.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'll credit my wife at this point. You know, her argument back when she was racing was that, you know, there is no such thing as the perfect training plan. You know, you keep it, yeah, Jimmy Buffett style, keep it between the navigational beacons, right? Within broad parameters, within broad strokes, you know, make sure what you're doing is appropriate and reasonable. And then the outcome, how successful you become, ends up hinging a lot more upon, well, how much talent you have, how much motivation you have, you know, the environment you're in, the, you know, support you have, et cetera. And not, oh, well, you know, I went and got a laboratory-based test so that I could train right at or below my, right above my LT1, because, you know, so-and-so says this is the optimal way of doing so. Yeah. And again, I mean, you think about the literature, the scientific literature, and how much people want to hang their hats on, you know, single studies, small ends, when really, science isn't good for answering a lot of these questions, or at least or especially on the individual level. I mean, what do we know about training? Well, we can describe in great detail the effects of training, you know, down to, you know, what genes are being switched on, what are switched off. But when it comes time to prescribing a training program, really what we have are only the big principles: specificity, overload, right? Reversibility, et cetera.
Well, that's what I was going to say as well. Just, you said specificity. So I don't want to give people to get the impression that no matter what training you do, you'll end up the same. Because if you did just do long, slow distance, then you're only teaching yourself to go slow, right? And you go then and try and do a, you know, I was more of a runner. So you go and try and do a 10K race, you're going to do crap because you haven't done anything at sort of anywhere near race pace.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have to think in terms of different sports as well. As you said, in running, I mean, the biomechanics of running slow are different from the biomechanics of running fast. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're pedaling a bike, I mean, it's the same crank length, the same saddle height, you know, the same two pistons going up and down at about the same, you know, RPM. And mm-hmm. all that's really changing is motor unit recruitment. And okay, well, I need to train my, you know, more difficult to recruit type 2 motor units, well, just ride long enough and your type 1s will become fatigued. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, it's different when you start talking about running. And then, you know, again, my son's a swimmer, and I start thinking about what Jim Martin kind of refers to as duty cycle. If you look at swimming or rowing, although they're primarily aerobic sports, the duty cycle is much longer. It's like when you turn the muscles on, they have to stay on for a much longer period of time, because your stroke rates are lower both swimming and rowing than they would be, you know, say your step rate while running or cadence while cycling. And then, you know, what are the implications for this? As I have to think through it, it's like, well, most of the blood flow occurs when the muscle's relaxed, not when it's contracting. Because when it's contracting, intramuscular pressure is too high and you don't get much blood flow. And then you start thinking about, well, how important are the muscle contractile properties? as a limiter versus, you know, energy turnover, et cetera. So you start getting really into the details here with a particular sport. But it back to, you know, back to kind of training zones and Mike's comments, I had long made the point in USA coaching education clinics that on the one hand, the adaptations to exercise training are enormously complex. You know, we alter the expression of thousands of genes, right? And yet, on the other hand, from another perspective, they're really quite simple. Everything that happens either increases the maximal force or power that the muscle can generate, or it increases the duration at which the muscle can maintain a submaximal force or power output. So you have type one. Let's say you have type A and type B adaptations, right? And then you could probably subdivide the type B adaptations into those that enhance fatigue resistance during, you know, very high intensity, non-sustainable exercise. You know, you're running 400 meters, you're doing a cycling pursuit or whatever, versus those that enhance fatigue resistance during, you know, more prolonged, lower intensity exercise, 10K, running a marathon, time trial, whatever. And so these, the B1 and the B2 may be subtly different. But really in broad strokes, that's it. And everything else is details, you know, best left under the hood for the exercise molecular biologists, right? It's like, what kind of adaptation are you trying to pursue? Well, there's only three. So, okay, well, you know, what are the adaptations and how do I induce them? Well, like you said, over broad spectrum, you can do anything from, you know, very prolonged lower intensity exercise, or you can do, you know, short, intense interval training. And how does the muscle respond? More capillaries, more mitochondria, you know, probably going to decrease your glycogenolytic enzymes a little bit. You're going to reduce your LDH, you know, a fair bit. You're going to produce more GLUT4 transporters. It's like there's only like one program by which the muscle can respond over very broad swaths, you know. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, my wife was a track cyclist and I didn't really come to fully appreciate cycling as a sport until I got to know her, because if you don't consider what happens on the track, it's like going to athletics, track and field, and only watching the marathon and not going to the stadium, right? I mean, you need to bring in the velodrome, the true match sprinters, the true sprint cyclists, the BMXers, before you start talking about, you know, the very far left end of the intensity duration spectrum in terms of cycling. But once you get out beyond, you know, a handful of minutes, it's all the same thing, you know.
All right, great. All right, so I think we've covered this. I was just having a bit of a look at some of these Twitter questions. I think we've basically covered a lot of them, you know, without specifically asking the question. So Jim Kalane's zones imply there are some metabolic anchors. FTP is not that. CP is not that. Critical power. Lactate threshold is not.
I would dispute that. In that, again, physiological responses take place on a continuum. You could say that they are threshold-like, even recognizing that it occurs on a continuum. I mean, there is an elbow in the curve. It's a fairly narrow range of intensities over where we can do a pretty good job of maintaining a metabolic steady state and then go just a little bit harder. And the, you know, the wheels are all going to progressively fall off. So this is why I refer to it as a quasi metabolic steady state. Because even if you're below that intensity, you can't maintain a perfect metabolic steady state forever. You know, VO2 will drift upwards even below critical power, et cetera. And, you know, even if you adjusted the power output and, you know, measured VO2 frequently with a metabolic cart and kept tweaking the power output to try and keep VO2 constant, okay, power is going to decline, but also like your catecholamines would go up over time. Your heart rate would go up over time. Mm-hmm. So there is no true metabolic steady state. You can't maintain resting metabolic rate for longer than what, 4 score and 10, right? The duration of your life, right? Even that low of an intensity can't be maintained forever.
That's true. So
that's why I refer to it as a quasi metabolic steady state. But recognizing all of those nuances, nonetheless, it's a fairly narrow range over which things begin to change rather rapidly. And because performance is dependent upon the metabolic responses to exercise, that becomes the logical place to anchor any kind of training prescription. And these are not new thoughts. These are ideas that have been in the exercise science field for, as long as I've been around, and they keep resurfacing. So you can probably find, didn't David Bishop do a review somewhat recently where he's making the exact same argument? And I'm sitting there looking at it going, 30 years ago, we knew this. Why do we need another review? Well, we blame A.V. Hill and VO2 max because he got there first in 1924, right? And it's taken a long time to undermine, that perspective. But then the devil is in the details, right? Okay, if we all accept that there is some reasonable anchor point in there between sustainable and non-sustainable intensity, how do we go about determining it, right? Is it best to base it on physiological measurements? I would argue, and Andy Jones would apparently agree, no, it's actually best to base it upon performance measurements, power, mm-hmm. if it's a measurable kind of thing. And then you can get further into the devil in the details there. Well, do you use 95% of 20-minute power, which is what Hunter Allen has proposed, or do you use critical power testing? But that's getting way off into the weeds.
Right. So one of the questions was Simon Marwood, and you've just talked about that. What is a quasi steady state? So you've talked about that. I'm just trying to see if we've covered things now. Jose Manuel Valverde. So he talks about the thing you said already. So Dr. Inigo San Milan always emphasizes that the introduction of high intensity in a zone 2 ride negates its benefits as high intensity efforts hinder aerobic pathways. So talking about the lactate for several minutes afterwards, this is hard to achieve outside of, so if you're an undulating course, how much is relevant? So we've talked about that.
Yeah, none whatsoever. You go for a Strava Prime at the start of your 3-hour ride and you blow yourself to bits. Yeah, the rest of your workout may not be of the highest quality, especially if your fitness isn't really there. So maybe that's not the best plan on a regular basis. But in terms of the physiology, physiology doesn't really care. Think big picture, right?
Actually, just back to the thing I asked at the start, and I remember we had some emails about it a couple of years ago. What was this controversy about FTP versus SUFFER score, the SUFFER fest?
Oh, right. We dropped that. I'm not sure, and maybe you're mixing a couple things. Wahoo,
quite possibly.
Fitness, yeah. Wahoo Fitness, they had a whole advertising campaign, FTP is dead. And then they started hyping 4DP, four-dimensional power.
Oh, that's
that
fun.
Is, you characterize somebody's, exercise or somebody's performance abilities on the basis of their maximal 5-second, 1-minute, 5-minute, and, sustainable power, which is the power profiling idea that I had introduced a decade or more before. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah.
That's what it was.
Apparently the people behind Wahoo don't have any ethics, right? I mean, this is the, I'll be blunt. this is the very definition of plagiarism, right? Using somebody else's words or ideas without giving proper credit, right?
Well, it's actually worse because they said FTP is dead.
Yeah. Makes no sense, does it, right?
So they're plagiarizing, but they also put knock down the thing they're plagiarizing.
Oh, lots of ways to make money in this world.
Is that a defamation or these defamational comments or not? Okay, so... Great. So I think if we covered pretty much everything, I didn't see all the Twitter because some came, I just got up out of bed and some more Twitter comments came through, but I think we pretty much covered everything. So what would your takeaway, I guess, if we're talking about takeaway messages from this and thinking about the topic, so you know, why all the talk about zone two, what would you like people to take away rather than just like, yeah.
I'm going to tip my hat to you here because, you know, your motivation for the podcast was the fact that there is a lot of misinformation out there. There are a lot of scientists who are getting their hands dirty working in the field who are the best source of information, the closest to the truth, right? And yet we live in an ivory tower where we're not incentivized to share with the public. Mm-hmm. Instead, you know, we're incentivized to chase grants, build our careers, you know, pay our summer salaries. And I am both a product and a victim of that entire system, and I recognize it, right? So I'll tip my hat for you for recognizing that, you know, you have an opportunity here to provide the pipeline, the insight into exercise. So in that context, aside from telling people, you know, listen, the Inside Exercise is my favorite podcast, the only one I listen to. In more big picture, I would say is, you know, be a skeptical consumer of information, mm-hmm. and truly consider the source. I mean, it's not that hard to get a PhD in exercise science, right? Just because somebody has credentials behind their name doesn't mean they know what they're talking about. Just because somebody is connected and, you know, has a bunch of really successful athletes doesn't mean that they necessarily know what they're talking about. So be a skeptical consumer, and yeah, you kind of have to triangulate amongst, you know, various sources of mm-hmm. information. But the other part of it is to realize that, you know, why are you interested in the first place, right? I mean, we're all curious creatures, and there are probably many people who, even if they aren't going to try and apply it to their own training, it is how they entertain themselves. They listen to Peter Attia or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. While they make their commute to work, passes the time while they're in the car. But it's also just a distraction. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, keep your eyes on the prize. Don't be confused, because the biggest mistake people make is they basically jump from the latest, you know, they jump from one training approach to another training approach. They respond to the latest guru. You know, back when Lance Armstrong was winning the Tour de France and Chris Carmichael was, you know, walked on water, everybody's like, oh, I got to spin to win. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so you see, you live long enough, you see these things come and go, and you realize what matters are the big principles. So, you know, don't get distracted by all of the talk.
Okay, that's great. Just thinking, something else I thought of the other day is, do people partly want to do zone two because it's easy? You know, so if you're going to ride your bike, and you go, oh, I should do zone two today.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the same sort of thing. Although there is, depending on how much time you have available, people like Steve Seiler have, you know, cautioned against the no-go zone, right? Spending all of your time going happy hard, right? Actually going happy hard is a good way of inducing adaptation. People ask about, well, is sweet spot, you know, where's the scientific evidence that sweet spot training is effective? It's like, do the math, dude. Almost every endurance exercise training study ever published has taken untrained people and trained them in the sweet spot, because that's what we as exercise physiologists do, right? We know that it's effective. You're not going to get improvements in a college student training 6 hours a week at 50% of VO2 max, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, what do? We put them, you know, pretty darn hard, you know, mm-hmm. sweet spot. Again, though, I was thinking about it. It's like there is some, we have three levers we can pull: frequency, duration, and intensity of training, right? And most people would take frequency and duration together and call that the volume of your training, right? Mm-hmm. So you have volume and you have intensity. What is the optimal volume? I mean, like I said, my son's a swimmer. My wife and I debate these things endlessly, right? There are high school swim programs here in Indiana. We're not in Indiana, but near in Indiana at home. where you know, they have high school kids training 20 hours a week. My son trains 10 hours a week. Well, my wife and I are convinced that he would be faster if he trained more. But how much more? You know, my on an individual basis, the only way to know is to, you know, do more until you crack, right? Mm. But my experience, my gut instinct, what have you, is that somewhere around, you know, the 15-hour a week mark is where you're starting to trade intensity for volume, that all roads lead to Rome, right? Mm. But okay, let's say you're training 15 hours a week and I want to get better. I got to go hard. That's not pleasant, right? Mm-hmm. So how much motivation do you have to do that, you know, 52 weeks a year, right? Or is it easier just to ride more and have fun, you know, and all roads lead to Rome, right? So there, you know, there's more than one way to skin the training cat. what we do know is that intensity is a significant factor. You could take any highly trained athlete, and if you put him into a pressure cooker training program short term, you can probably get further improvements, or you'll crack them, one of the two, right? But I think somebody like, you know, your average pro cyclist is probably running around anywhere, you know, depending on the time of year, 5 to 15% below their maximum performance ability, depending upon, you know, what parameter you're talking about, because it's a job and I've got to do this, you know, 50 weeks out of the year, right? Mm-hmm. And I can't have my nose to the grindstone 50 weeks out of the year. Motivation dries up.
Actually, that reminded me of something to tie together, because earlier on when you were talking about your VO2 max and your lactate threshold, I wanted to make sure people were clear on that. And I think this is a good example. So Shogard, 1988, showed Tour de France cyclists, when you look at them over a season, their VO2 max did not change over the season, but their performance and their mitochondrial enzymes changed 300%.
Yeah.
So that's the good to tie that together. The performance is more related to your peripheral.
Yeah.
You don't actually have to do that much to keep your VO2 max.
Pretty
it doesn't
close.
Really change that much. Yeah, exactly. No, it doesn't change that much once it's up already.
Yeah.
All right, great. So just a final takeaway, just specifically to the zone two stuff. What's your takeaway? So if someone gets off this, and then gets on Twitter and it's like, you've got to do everything at zone two, what would you say to them? What's your takeaway on that?
I think my gut is to say the same thing again, of the big picture, that, you know, the keys to training are the big factors: specificity, overload, progression, you know, reversibility, et cetera. So, I mean, I had a mental map, you know, if you were designing the training program for an athlete, you know, it's like, what are the demands of the event from a physiological perspective?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the characteristics of this athlete with respect to the demands of the event? How to best prepare this athlete for this event, right? Or maybe they should pick a different event, because they would, you know, be more successful at something else. So that's like an exit from the circle. But if you don't exit from the circle, you just keep coming back to the same question. What are the demands of the event? What are the current characteristics of the athlete? It's like, okay, well, we've raised your muscular metabolic fitness about as high as we possibly can. We might be able to get a little bit more if you wanted to do time trials, but you're targeting the pursuit. You're my wife. Okay, so it's instead, now it's time to focus on, you know, icing the cake by, you know, VO2 max intervals, and then a whole bunch of, you know, quote unquote anaerobic capacity intervals, go hard, puke, go home style of training, right? Because that's what, to do a one-off, you know, 3 kilometer pursuit as fast as possible, those are the capabilities that you need.
Specificity. All right. And then I was just thinking also, if someone was saying, what about if I'm not an athlete, I'm not training, I want to do it for health, I guess you'd say zone two may not be ideal for that either, because even though you might get the metabolic sort of, you know, you might reduce your blood pressure and cholesterol and things by doing a lot of low intensity type exercise. I know with Ben Levine was on here, he said you need to do a bit higher intensity to get the cardiovascular responses you want.
So, yeah. I mean, people are doing it for health. Presumably they're talking about doing it for the rest of their life, right? Hopefully they're not.
Yeah.
So it has to be something sustainable, something they enjoy doing, and something they can fit into their life, et cetera. Within that, if it's too intense, you know, you'll burn out and you'll jump from trainer road to full gas to Zwift to, you know, doing nothing to, you know, playing pickleball to back on the bike because the pandemic hit, you know, et cetera. But at least you're doing something, right? But if you're going to pick one sport and you're just going to do it, again, it still has to be sustainable. It still has to be something you enjoy. There is, you know, at the far end of things, is it possible to go too hard? There's emerging evidence in the cardiovascular disease realm that, you know, high intensity exercise could increase formation of calcium containing plaques in the coronary arteries. There are some case reports, you know, like 10% out of a cohort of 30 and then several papers, right? Where, you know, people like me who've done a lot of high, or you, we may have evidence of myocardial fibrosis based on MRI scans. But at the end of the day, if you start looking at, you know, mortality, et cetera, there's nothing, I mean, an acute bout of high intensity exercise increases your risk of sudden death, both while you're doing it immediately thereafter. But doing it on a repeated basis actually reduces your risk. And so despite, you know, the CAC scores data out there, the fibrosis changes, et cetera, it's still, you know, unknown whether these things have any true clinical significance.
Well, again, I'd point people in the direction of Ben Levine's podcast on that.
Yeah, because, he'd be the expert. Yeah.
No, because the good one was he did say that there's more calcification of plaques and things, but they're more stable. They're actually not.
Yeah, we used to talk about vulnerable and vulnerable plaques, right?
Yeah. So the they're more stable.
Yeah.
So they actually, even the people that have the more calcified plaques tend to live longer, and that there can be also increased atrial fibrillation, but there's still a lot more lower mortality. So so that's an interesting discussion. All right, so thank you very much.
Maybe I'll have to watch that episode.
There you go. There you go. So thank you very much again for coming on, Andy. And I'd like to point, if we're plugging other episodes, as I said at the start, the very first episode was with Andy Coggan talking about his nitrates and exercise stuff, which is really interesting as well. So enjoy your holiday, and I hope you don't have to spend too much time and annoy your family here with
I got one out of three down now, right?
Holy mackerel. You're going to end up in the bad books. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good to see you again, Glenn.
Thanks, Andy. See you.
Till next year.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. See you. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.